Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the April 10th reading of The Environment, a compilation of articles from the Nature Conservancy magazine, the magazine of the Sierra Club, and Mother Earth News. My name is John. Today, we'll be reading the following main articles from the magazine of the Sierra Club, How to Hit the Trail with Nothing But Amtrak and a Bicycle, written by Robert Annis, and our second main article, A Park for the Past in South Australia, written by Justine Hoshier. So back to our first article, How to Hit the Trail with Nothing But Amtrak and a Bicycle. From Idaho to Alabama to Maine, adventure outdoors without taking a single car ride or plane trip. Watching the United States roll by on the California Zephyr Amtrak from Chicago to Sacramento last year, I constantly struggled with the impulse to jump off and explore. Seemingly, around every bend, there was a new, gorgeous trout stream or lake reflecting the mountains in the distance. I'd see a trail leading up into the spruce-filled hills and think, I wonder where it leads. The temptation was nearly unbearable. This summer, I'm hopping aboard Amtrak's Empire Builder route from Chicago to Seattle, and this time, I built a lot more flexibility into my trip to feed my insatiable curiosity and incurable wanderlust. Here's how you can plan a similar trip. Train travel is not just for getting from city to city. A number of Amtrak routes across the United States offers a great low-carbon way to see the outdoors, and an Amtrak USA Rail Pass allows you to string together a series of hiking, biking, swimming, and camping adventures with a hop-on, hop-off approach. This pass, good for 10 rides over 30 days, typically sells for $4.99, but Amtrak runs sales every year for $50 off or even more. I'm not alone in my love of passenger rail. Amtrak ridership grew by 25% in 2023, with the trend not looking to slow down anytime soon. Trains are often less expensive, more convenient, and more environmentally friendly than flying. You can also relax and safely enjoy the scenery more so than if you were driving a car. Some train stations are conveniently located right next to your final outdoorsy destination, but many present last-mile gaps that adventurers need to close. Instead of calling an Uber, intrepid adventurers can roll out on e-bikes. Chicagoan, cyclist, and frequent rail rider Matt Weiss estimates he's taken around 40 Amtrak trips over the last decade, many of which included his trusty bicycle. Trains and bikes go hand in hand for me as a mobility solution, Weiss says, allowing him to easily get around after he reaches his destination. Having an e-bike with you does negate some of the spontaneousness of train travel, as you need to reserve space for them on the train. On most routes, bikes cost an extra $5 to $20 to bring along. To find out the specific cost on your route, click the Add Bike to Trip button at checkout. Even Amtrak's biggest supporters admit the bike service could be hit or miss in the past, but Weiss says he's noticed improvement in recent years. On routes such as the Vermonter and Downeaster, some newer coaches now allow bikes to be rolled on board and hung on racks near the passenger seating. Typically, there are about 6 roll-on spaces for bicycles per train car. Those spots can sell out surprisingly early, so I try to plan ahead, he says. When I have an idea of when I will be making a trip, I get my space reserved as soon as possible. On routes without roll-on service, bikes are treated as checked luggage and placed inside the baggage car, which is not accessible during the train journey. Passengers with bikes should arrive early in order to check their bicycle, typically 30 to 45 minutes before departure. More than likely, riders will be asked to remove any pannier bags and the extra gear they hold. So where can an Amtrak train and an e-bike take you? Amtrak passes through several famous and incredibly beautiful national parks, such as Glacier and New River Gorge, and you can find many more lesser-known gorgeous spots just off the beaten path. Here are seven places, organized by route, that could serve as a jumping-off point. Sand Point, Idaho. One of the most breathtakingly beautiful states in the U.S., Idaho is too often forgot about, save for locals and hardcore outdoor enthusiasts. Surrounded by the Idaho Panhandle National Forest, Sandpoint is a great base for adventurers looking for incredible hiking, paddling, and fly fishing. The nearly 8-mile hike up and down Scotchman Peak may be difficult, but the views at the top are an apt reward for your efforts. Snow sports enthusiasts should not miss the world-class Schweitzer Ski Resort. La Crosse, Wisconsin. Fly fishers around the nation flock annually to the Midwest Driftless Region, so named because it was bypassed during the last glacial drift, allowing it to retain its steep hillsides and narrow valleys. Native brown and brook trout love the cold limestone-fed creeks, which means anglers love them as well. Just east of the town of La Crosse, the Little La Crosse River is categorized as a Class 1 trout stream, ranked among the best in Wisconsin. Not interested in fishing? Granddad Bluff Park offers some great hiking. On the Crescent Route, Anniston, Alabama. You will find more than 35 miles of top-notch mountain bike single track on Coldwater Mountain, just southwest of Anniston, with more hiking, fishing, and camping opportunities due south in Chaya National Park and the surrounding Talladega National Forest, the southernmost tip of the Appalachian Mountains. Traveling on the California Zephyr Route, check out Truckee, California. Upon disembarking at the Truckee station, you're confronted with an embarrassment of options. Ski North Star or head into Tahoe National Forest for a hike out to Paradise Lake. Wet a line on the Truckee River or paddle the impossibly blue Lake Tahoe to the south. Pedal the paved 9-mile Martis Valley Trail, surrounded by wildflowers, or rocket down the 14-mile Flume Trail single track overlooking the massive lake. There are no wrong choices, except maybe sitting still. Grand Junction, Colorado. Surrounded by Colorado National Monument to the southwest, Books Cliffs Mountain Range to the north, and Grand Mesa to the east, Grand Junction offers dramatic granite and sandstone backdrops for nearly every door activity you might desire. Pedaling west on the 22-mile Riverfront Trail, riders wind their way through Grand Junction and its sister communities of Fruta and Palisade before reaching the world-famous Cocopelli Mountain Bike Trail System, where you'll find some of the most fun and challenging single track in the U.S. Follow the dirt trails even farther, and you'll wind up in Moab, Utah. From the Amtrak, Sunset Limited, and Texas Eagle Routes, Tucson, Arizona. Saguaro National Park, separated in half by the city of Tucson, offers a couple of great, albeit much too short, loops for road bicycling, along with several miles of hike-only trails. The Sendero Espinosa Trail, in particular, should not be missed, offering beautiful views for miles atop the ridgeline. from Amtrak's Down Easter route, Old Orchard Beach, Maine. Just south of the renowned outdoor hub of Portland, Maine, the Old Orchard Beach Station sits within walking distance of gorgeous beaches and deep-sea fishing options. Motion Surf and Scape Shop offers both group and private surfing lessons to travelers wanting to brave the chilly Atlantic waters. The stop is seasonal, open from May to October. A note on the author. Robert Annis is a freelance reporter specializing in cycling and outdoor travel journalism. Previously, he spent nearly a decade as a reporter for the Indianapolis Star. His work has appeared in Outside, National Geographic Traveler, Afar, Bicycling, Men's Journal, Popular Mechanics, Lonely Planet, The Chicago Tribune, and Adventure.com. He is also a contributing editor at Indianapolis Monthly and is American Wild Magazine's Vagabond at Large. You can find his work at roberttanis.contently.com or follow him at Twitter at roberttanis. Today's second article from the Nature Conservancy, A Park for the Past. The new Neil Pena Ediacara National Park in South Australia preserves wild evolutionary history and a rich desert landscape. Written by Justin Hoshier. Three quarters of a century ago, geologist Reginald Sprigg found an odd-shaped imprint in the rocks of the Ediacara Hills. Located 6 hours north of Adelaide, South Australia, the area is a landscape that anyone but a geologist would describe as barren. Crumbling iron-stained earth, scrubby vegetation, and a summer heat that melts the asphalt. The strange fossil he discovered was shaped like a pancake and ribbed like a palm frond, an imprint of some long-ago creature laid down in the sand. Sprigg did not know it then, but he had just discovered what was, at that time, the earliest fossil evidence of complex multicellular animal life on Earth. The landscape of low hills surrounding his find would later lend its name to a newly discovered geological period, the Ediacaran, and the fossils within would prove an inflection point in our understanding of how life evolved on our planet. Today, the site is known as Nilpena Ediacara National Park. In 2020, with the assistance of the Nature Conservancy, the South Australian government acquired a vast swath of the area from its previous private landowner. The park protects not only the area's fossil treasures, but also threatened woodland habitats, endangered wildlife, and Aboriginal cultural heritage sites. It's a place where the biodiversity of the past and present meet, where kangaroos and bearded dragons sun themselves atop fossils of their earliest ancestors. This place captures the dawn of animal life, the initial diversification of animals, of things that move and reproduce in different ways, says Mary Droser, a paleontologist at the University of California, Riverside, who has studied fossils at Nilpena for more than 20 years. It is an extraordinary place, and it does not matter that the organisms are half a billion years old. Droser explains that for a portion of the Ediacaran period between 635 to 541 million years ago, this section of Australian outback was a shallow sea, where Earth's earliest animals scuttled across a mat of organic scum that built up on the ocean floor. Occasionally, a storm would blow over the sea, washing in sediments that would settle to deposit a layer of fresh sand and smother many creatures in place. For paleontologists, that layering of microbial mat and fresh sand is what makes Nilpena such an extraordinary fossil site. The organic mat works as a separator between the storms, like when you buy steaks and there's that paper between them that makes them easy to pull apart, says Droser. We've excavated these beds turned them over, and reconstructed large swaths of seafloor that are literal snapshots of the Ediacaran Sea. Droser and her team have discovered more than a dozen new genera in Nelpenia's rocks. Over the years, Nelpenia has revealed the raisin-shaped Anton Barytes, named for Sir David Attenborough, and Obamus coronatus, a small round fossil that looks like a braided pastry and is named for the former U.S. president. A lot of our discoveries happen because we're on our hands and knees and we're like, what the heck is this? Nelpenia is one of a handful of prolific Ediacaran sites in the world, and the only one where paleontologists have excavated whole beds. That allows Droser to reconstruct the lost ecosystem and investigate a host of questions that paleontologists are rarely able to study, particularly how these early life forms may have interacted with one another. To help answer those questions, the paleontologists use a combination of mapping and imagery techniques, including laser scanning and photogrammetry, to digitize the fossil seafloor. They take the data with them for further study in California, leaving the fossils where they found them. We can ask very different questions and get a really deep insight in Nelpenia, says Droser. We have the oldest bilaterarian in the research world, she says, referring to the symmetrical body plan shared by essentially all modern animal life, except corals and sponges. Within these rocks, they've found the earliest evidence of animal mobility, scavenging behavior, and even sexual reproduction, finds that are contributing to what scientists know about the history of life on Earth. Perhaps almost as wondrous is that these fossils have survived all this time. For more than 150 years, Nelpenia has been the site of working sheep and cattle stations, the term for a ranch in Australia. But its most recent owners, Ross and Jane Farger, appreciated the land's biological and paleontological heritage and took care not to overgraze their lands. In an interview with Science, Ross Farger said that he first noticed some unusual rocks on his property in the mid-1980s, when a visitor pointed out the wave-like ripple rock that made up the floor of his 100-year-old wool shed. Soon, paleontologists and looters were carting loads of rocks back to Adelaide. Alarm bells started to go off, he told Science, describing how sites in both Nelpenia and the Ediacara Hills were pretty well stripped bare. Farger agreed to allow research on his property, but only if scientists left the fossils where they found them, keeping Nelpenia's rich paleontological heritage in place. In January 2020, the Nature Conservancy helped the South Australian government purchase almost 150,000 acres of the 211,000-acre Nelpenia Station with funding provided by the Weiss Foundation, a campaign of the Swiss philanthropist Hans-Jörn Weiss. The new Nelpenia Ediacara National Park, which opened to the public in April 2023, protects the site's extraordinary fossils while also adding critical ecosystems to the country's collection of protected areas, a step toward hitting the country's conservation targets. Australia committed to following the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework, an international agreement to reserve the loss of wildlife and habitat. A key part of the agreement is the 30 by 30 target, which asks nations to conserve at least 30% of their lands and oceans by 2030. Australia currently has about 22% of its land under protection, says James Fitzsimmons, the senior advisor to global protection strategies for TNC. But, he says, 29 of the country's 89 bioregions have less than 10% of their area protected. A key element of 30 by 30 is ensuring the protected area network is ecologically representative, says Fitzsimmons. That means ensuring the full range of ecosystems and habitat types are included and emphasizing areas of particular importance for biodiversity. The creation of this national park boosts protection for Australia's Gawler bioregion, which has vast salt lakes, spinifex grasslands, and rocky hills and plains interspersed with arid woodlands. Home to several species at risk of extinction, including the endangered thick-billed grass wren, the parkland also includes two threatened ecological communities within it, River Red Gum Woodlands and Mulga Low Woodlands. Both provide habitat for a variety of animal species. Insects and insectivorous bird species are attracted to the small flowering shrubs, says Jason Irving, director for National Parks Programs at the Department for Environment and Water in South Australia. Raptors such as wedge-tailed eagles make their nests in the larger trees. Small mammals, such as fat-tailed dunnarts, can use shrubs as habitat, hunting insects by night. And old-growth river red gum trees are especially critical for wildlife, as their hollow branches and trunks provide shelter and nesting sites for species like parrots, lizards, and small animals. The park also protects cultural heritage sites of the Adyamanthana people, the traditional owners of the land who camped near permanent springs, leaving behind ash and charcoal middens that can still be seen thousands of years later. The South Australian government is partnering with the Adyamanthana to help protect heritage sites and incorporate traditional ecological knowledge into park management. Neil Pena was the first of several land purchases facilitated by the Nature Conservancy in Australia in recent years. Other recent deals have protected savanna woodlands on Cape York Peninsula and nationally significant wetlands in New South Wales. A key part of the Nature Conservancy's protection strategy in Australia, says Fitzsimmons, is the organization's flexibility. Rather than purchasing the land outright, TNC works with nonprofit organizations, indigenous groups, and state governments to create new protected areas under a variety of different mechanisms. To date, the organization has assisted in the protection of around 50 million acres, a collective area roughly the size of South Dakota or Nebraska. For Neil Pena, now 1 year into becoming a national park, the efforts to conserve the area have just begun. The land sits within the Flinders Ranges region, home to the most renowned mountain range in South Australia, which is currently being considered for UNESCO World Heritage status. The mountains, about 45 minutes due east of the new park, are one of Australia's iconic landscapes and home to vulnerable species like the yellow-footed rock wallaby and western quoll. Creating the Neil Pena Ejiakara National Park means we can manage the fossil sites to ensure security and management regimes are put in place while providing for controlled visitor access and ongoing research, says Irving. This will enable the potential World Heritage values to be protected in perpetuity and shared with the world. Droser and her team still return to Neil Pena each year, crawling across the ancient seafloor to match each and every blob or squiggle on the sandstone. People ask me, why is this place important? It's about understanding that the Earth has a history and that there are organisms that went extinct because of past environmental change, she says. It's because we have to understand the fate of past life on Earth to better understand our future. And that's our time for this reading. Thank you so much for joining us for the April 10th reading of the Colorado Sun. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.